You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
It's Monday, April 22nd. He got his bills passed. He just needed Democrats to help him do it. We start here. After months of resistance, House Speaker Mike Johnson pushes through aid for Ukraine.
Do you believe you will still be the speaker come November?
Yes.
Yes, absolutely, without question.
Yes.
But does this now leave him in a political no man's land? Israel and Iran try to tamp down their tempers.
Everyone agrees that it's in neither side's interest for an all-out war.
But will it be enough to prevent a regional war? And they'll tell you every day is Earth Day, but that doesn't mean they don't want electricity.
All right, this is the moment. Look at that.
Oh, my.
Why thousands of Navajo homes are finally getting clean power after nearly a century of waiting. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. We talk often about how much power seems to have tilted away from Congress in Washington and towards the presidency, especially when it comes to foreign affairs, right? The president is the commander-in-chief. He's our chief diplomat. Plus, Congress so rarely agrees on anything that even if they could impact foreign events, they don't.
Three of our primary adversaries, Russia and Iran and China, are working together. And they're being aggressors around the globe.
Well, this weekend, you could almost see House Speaker Mike Johnson saying to himself, this is our shot. Several of these global issues stand before Congress waiting for us to act.
I think we did our work here, and I think history will judge it well.
The Republican speaker teed up several huge votes, some of which have conceivably put his own job at risk. When the smoke cleared, it was Democrats who had made the difference on some of these, but Congress is still on the verge of doing something the president can't, which is sending huge aid packages to Ukraine and Israel. Let's bring in ABC's Jay O'Brien to start the week. He covers Congress. Jay, as far as the legislation is concerned, can you break down sort of, I guess, what the biggest takeaway was here?
So this is a package of four bills, Brad. It has aid for Israel and Taiwan, and there's also legislation to force a sale of TikTok. But the biggest takeaway, at least legislatively, is this Ukraine funding, because it's been stalled in Congress for months. The last time Congress passed a standalone aid package for Ukraine was when Democrats were in charge of the House in 2022. And legislation to help Ukraine in its defense against Russia has been languishing in Congress really since that time. And for a long time, it got tied up in this debate over the border. And it was something that Speaker Kevin McCarthy, when he was Speaker, was grappling with. And it was something that Speaker Mike Johnson was frankly delaying putting on the floor for a long time. Until Mike Johnson makes the decision, Republicans who are close to him tell us, to do what Johnson has said is the quote-unquote right thing.
I've said it very simply. I'll say it once again. It's an old military adage, but we would rather send bullets to the conflict overseas than our own boys, our troops.
One Republican who was with Johnson the night before he made his decision said that Johnson remarked that he wanted to be on the, quote, right side of history. And that is why he said to his conference, I don't care if you're going to vote for this or not vote for it. I'm going to put this aid package on the floor. And more importantly, it is inside of it going to have $60 billion for Ukraine. And that's what he did.
On this vote, the ayes are 311 and the nays are 112. The bill is passed.
But notably, Brad, there were four bills, four individual votes. But on the Ukraine vote, more Republicans voted against Ukraine aid than for it.
We should not secure the borders of nations abroad.
The European Union can do more.
America last. That's all this is. Every single day.
And that is why Johnson needed Democratic votes to get that support for Ukraine over the goal line.
But I mean, for decades now, sort of going against the majority of your own conference has been considered a big no-no, especially with Republicans. The fact that Johnson had to rely on Democrats here, I mean, is that the sort of thing that could cost a speaker his job?
Oh, it's angering hardline Republicans, and some of them are more angry than others. Some are just fed up with Johnson. They say he should have focused on border security, and others, like Marjorie Taylor Greene, want him out.
He did this bullshit in here on the House floor, foreign war package that does nothing for America.
There are now at least two other Republicans who have joined Marjorie Taylor Greene in her efforts to oust Johnson.
The vote was held today. Mike Johnson is a lame duck.
He's done.
She's already called what's called a motion to vacate against Johnson, but she hasn't brought it to the floor for a vote. And instead, what she's doing is holding this motion to vacate, which is the same thing that got rid of Kevin McCarthy, over Johnson's head and try to push him to resign.
I don't walk around this building being worried about a motion to vacate. I have to do my job.
Johnson, meanwhile, says he's not going anywhere. I asked him after that dramatic vote.
Mr. Speaker, I know you just mentioned motion to vacate, but do you believe you will still be the speaker come November?
Yes,
absolutely, without question.
Yes.
Because of how slim the Republican numbers are, eventually Johnson would probably need at least a few moderate Democrats to bail him out.
Well, and in regard to then this whole package of bills that they were passing in the House this weekend, so there was the Ukraine aid, Israel now gets several billion dollars in aid as well. You mentioned border security. A kind of watered-down border security bill was voted on, but it was far-right conservatives and Democrats who did not even allow that to go through. What happens next? Like, some of the ones that passed here, they need to pass in the Senate, right?
So they're all now packaged together into what is essentially one bill. And the Senate is going to take each of these four pieces of legislation together as one vehicle. And that's important because it means all of this stuff is wrapped into one bow. And so when you think about that legislation, for instance, to force a sale of TikTok away from its Chinese parent company, and if that sale doesn't happen, then the app could be banned. Right now, the choice that the Senate is facing is if it wants to vote for that aid for Israel and Ukraine, for instance, it also has to vote for that legislation aimed at TikTok.
The thing that they've been wanting to vote on for months now is also tied to the sale of TikTok.
Correct. And by the way, remember, the House sent them a bill about forcing a sale of TikTok, and the Senate kind of dragged its feet on it. This is an election year. This is not an issue that a lot of young voters are in support of, taking action against TikTok. And there were senators who said they had serious concerns with the legislation. It gave ByteDance too short of a window to potentially sell if this bill became law. That window has now been extended from 6 months to a year, and that has gotten the support of some pretty high-profile Democrats who now say they're on board with this legislation aimed at TikTok that they previously weren't on board with. TikTok, by the way, is balking at all of this. They say that this bill could strip the app away from 170 million U.S. users, Brad.
That'll be fascinating to see if one thing could kind of derail this thing that both the Senate and Speaker Johnson have been pushing for, which are these aid bills. See if TikTok, of all things, ends up being the new reason this aid doesn't go through. Jay O'Brien, after a busy weekend in Congress, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, if you don't acknowledge an attack, you don't have to respond to the attack. We'll head to the Middle East after the break. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Have you ever wondered what you would do with an extra hour in your day? I think about this all the time. I'm like, I would be so productive. I'd exercise more, or I'd read a book, or I'd take a nap, like restore myself. We often find ourselves yearning for these extra hours, but the real question is, what would you do if you were making yourself a priority? Well, how about therapy? It can help you discover what's important so you can make the most of your time. If you've ever benefited from therapy, you know how transformative it can be. It's not just for those who have experienced major trauma. Therapy empowers you to learn positive coping skills, set boundaries, and become the best version of yourself. If you're considering starting therapy, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and tailored to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire. You'll be matched with a licensed therapist. And here's the beauty of it. You can switch therapists if you're not finding the right fit. No additional charge. Take the first step. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/start here today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/start here. With daylight saving time upon us, we're looking forward to more daylight and longer days from March through November. And while setting our clocks forward gives us the illusion of more time, it doesn't necessarily help businesses find qualified candidates any sooner. Fear not, there is a solution. ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter's your 24/7 hiring partner working tirelessly to connect you with the right candidate. Once you post your job on ZipRecruiter, it gets distributed to over 100 job sites, ensuring you reach a diverse pool of qualified individuals. Their smart technology scans thousands of resumes, matching you with people whose skills perfectly align with your job requirements. Spring forward with a new hiring partner, ZipRecruiter, and find top talent sooner. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free, ZipRecruiter.com/start here. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/start here. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. So heading into this past weekend, Israel had just attacked Iran on Iranian soil, the latest act of retaliation in this back and forth that's really ratcheted up beyond anything we've ever seen from these two countries. Iran had promised that if Israel did fire into Iran, it would unleash an even bigger response. So for days, everyone's been wondering, what will Iran do about this strike? To which Iran now seems to be saying, strike? What strike? They're not even acknowledging internally to their citizens that anything's happened here. Let's figure all this out with ABC's foreign correspondent Tom Sufi Burge, who's there in Tel Aviv right now. Tom, this has gotten wild. Can you just catch us up on what's been happening there?
Yeah, Brad, look, the Israeli strike was limited in scope, but a senior U.S. official briefing ABC News has given some pretty intriguing detail. But effectively, that official saying that Israeli war jets were involved and that they fired from outside of Iranian airspace, and that they were targeting an air defense radar system near the central Iranian city of Isfahan in a military base, but close to Iran's key nuclear facility of Natanz. But the official underlining that the nuclear site was not the target. Mm. So the message everyone is saying, and this official is saying, is that Israel was sending a warning, a very clear warning. We have the capabilities. We can fly in. We can shoot very near, destroy that radar defending the site. And if we wanted to, but we won't this time, we could even hit your most prized assets like your nuclear facilities.
That's interesting, though, Tom, that you're saying this is like a warning. This is not the huge counterstrike, you know, blanketing a military base like some had feared. This is actually a little less than that, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a massive, massive strike. And what's critical is not only did the Israelis not own it, which suggests that they kind of went back to their modus operandi of the past, right? And that is targeting Iranian proxies and interests in the region, but not owning those strikes. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the Iranians sitting back, playing down the scope of this attack, playing down the importance of it, claiming that only drones were involved. We think drones could have been involved. It's just not clear. Hmm. But the Iranians are playing it down. You know, you saw Iranian state TV within hours of that attack showing scenes of normalcy in Isfahan, and Iran saying, look, our nuclear sites weren't hit. It's nothing.
Is that then, are you saying essentially each side, when they could be ratcheting up, this sounds like steps for each side to ratchet down the tension a little bit. Israel tells its people, we're doing a big strike, but then they hit one thing in Iran. Iran says, we're going to go hard at them. And then they're like, actually, we're just not going to acknowledge this at all. Is this them bringing it down?
Oh, look, every analyst we've spoken to, every former Israeli military official we've spoken to over the last week agrees. It's not in Iran's or Israel's interest for a massive all-out war between the two sides.
We should not take any actions that if we make a miscalculation might drag the whole region to a cycle of violence and everybody later might blame Israel. It is a risk that we should not take.
One former Israeli military official we spoke to said, look, in their opinion, Israel might not have all the ammunition and arms and really the will to go to war with Iran in a prolonged way.
We can continue and fight against important Iranian targets in other places, especially in Syria, something that we do successfully in the past 9 years. And this is important because it can prevent the establishment of another Hezbollah in Syria.
And the Iranian economy isn't doing great. The regime, you know, it's not that long ago that we had mass protests all across Iran. But everyone agrees that it's in neither side's interest for an all-out war.
Okay, so then this is one of those situations then where you would expect the U.S. and Israel to be in lockstep, right? Like Israel was just attacked by Iran. Israel does the strike back. U.S. has been sanctioning Iranians. And yet, now, this morning, it sounds like we're hearing the U.S. might sanction Israelis. What is that about?
Yeah, look, on the fundamentals, I think what we just talked about demonstrates that the fundamentals of the Israeli-American relationships is really, really strong. But that doesn't mean that the Biden administration and Prime Minister Netanyahu's government are not at loggerheads on key issues.
We cannot support a major military operation in Rafah.
Firstly, Gaza. We know the Israelis want to get into Rafah as soon as possible. The Biden administration is saying, don't do it without protecting the civilian population there. And now the Biden administration is also taking action. We believe it's not confirmed. US officials right now are not confirming this. But Prime Minister Netanyahu is already coming out and saying, if you sanction an IDF unit, we are going to oppose that with all our might. And the story behind this is an ultra-Orthodox unit of the Israeli Defense Forces. It's called Netzach Yehuda. Basically, in the late 90s, it was set up, then was deployed to the occupied West Bank. It was in charge of security there, effectively. And over a course of a number of years, they were accused of multiple human rights abuses. The most notorious case was in 2022, the death of a Palestinian-American man, a 78-year-old man who was arrested by soldiers from that unit and then gagged and abandoned in the street in the middle of the night in the depths of winter, and he had a heart attack and died. Now, the IDF says soldiers involved in that case were disciplined. The Biden administration is potentially looking to limit or restrict the supply of US weaponry to that specific unit. Now, if confirmed, it's just not clear how in practice that would actually work.
Well, and the Israeli defense minister came out last night saying the whole world is watching our relationship right now and that this sends a bad signal. He said, quote, this is not the right path for partners and friends, end quote. But I think it's also helpful to remember that Benjamin Netanyahu is in power in part because of the ultra-Orthodox community. They do not want an embarrassment there. Still a lot to unfold here. Tom Sufi Burge there in Tel Aviv. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Today is Earth Day, and this whole week across all of ABC's platforms, we're going to be highlighting stories that reflect where our planet is at. Like, remember that 1.5 degrees Celsius threshold the Paris Agreement talked about? The idea that if the global temperature goes 1.5 degrees higher than pre-industrial levels, that we're all in trouble? Well, according to a recent study, global temperatures last year exceeded that threshold. Some of the most important change undoubtedly needs to come from government and corporate interests, but you've also got individuals who have essentially said, we can't wait for these entities to act. We've got to do something ourselves, which is why this year we're calling this series of stories The Power of Us. And recently, ABC's chief meteorologist and climate correspondent Ginger Z traveled to America's largest Indian reservation, Navajo Nation, where in the year 2024, people are fighting to get electricity in their own homes. Ginger joins us now. And Ginger, when I first heard you describing this, I was thinking, you must mean these folks don't have renewable energy, or they don't have affordable energy.
No.
You meant, like, they don't have electricity at all.
Do not have electricity, and nor do they use it. And it's not just a couple people in Navajo Nation. It's 15,000 homes. That is estimated up to about 60,000 people that live without not just the niceties of flipping a light on or having a refrigerator to refrigerate your food, but telehealth, education via the internet, all of it. So we went to Arizona.
Let's hit it. Let's get out into Navajo Nation.
We met up with a guy called Brett Isaac in Flagstaff, and then we drove into Navajo Nation.
So we're in the western part of the Navajo Nation, and this is like the high desert.
It is such expansive, gorgeous land, and it doesn't just stop in Arizona.
It's roughly the size of West Virginia, kind of straddling New Mexico, Arizona, and Utah, with the majority of the land being in Arizona.
There are more than 200,000 people that still live on Navajo land there. And so, even though they're very spread out, you do see population, and it certainly follows roads, and it certainly follows what looks like power lines, because there are power lines everywhere through Navajo Nation. But many of them are not powering the homes of the Navajo people.
Wait, so there are power lines there, and yet they're not powering those homes right below them? Why is that?
Correct. So Brett was telling me that Navajo Nation is kind of called the battery of the Southwest.
Cities like Las Vegas and Los Angeles wouldn't be in existence without the coal resources that were extracted on the Navajo Nation and, you know, converted to electrons through the power plants that operated here for years.
And so a lot of, you know, land leases were made throughout history from the federal government, from all these places, so that we could power up the desert Southwest. In the process, though,
they built this infrastructure, but it wasn't built for the people here. And I think for a lot of people, it's like those power lines represent an era when promises were made but not upheld.
And there were a lot of, we're going to get to you, we're going to get to you, and then it didn't happen. But there's also something really important called the Bennett Freeze. So this is a 1966 law. And basically, there were some oil and gas leasing issues, they say, between the Hopi and the Navajo people. The federal government said, listen, if we can't agree on whose land is whose and who gets what out of these oil and gas leases, we're going to put kind of a moratorium on any building.
The freeze essentially said we cannot build, improve, renovate any type of infrastructure unless both tribes and the federal government consent to that work. And getting two nations along with the federal government to agree to do anything is very, very difficult.
That law that went into place in 1966 went through 2009.
At the same time this country was landing on the moon, they were telling us we couldn't build here. These people were frozen in time and actually, in some instances, regressed because of that lack of access.
So I asked Brett, I was like, was there malice in that?
I mean, I think a lot of the initiative was, you know, they wanted the tribes and the people and everyone to just merely adopt, you know, an American lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. He said, you know, this is how academia kind of refers to that era of assimilation. They very much wanted Navajo people to leave their pastoral land and go to cities. Mm. That is well known and well documented. And if you think about how do you get somebody to get out, I'd say not have them grow with the rest of the, it's fascinating.
Well, and so if you're there and you're talking about like the power of us, what can be done? What are there solutions there?
There are huge solutions. And that's the beauty of Brett Isaac. He said, instead of living under these power lines that were not meant for us, he said he took any frustration and put it forward into making change. And so Brett is the founder and the president of Navajo Power.
At its heart, it's a development company. We do clean energy development across the country on tribal lands.
First thing is he's bringing off-grid solar to Navajo people to power up homes that have never had power before.
Every time we do that, you know, you're kind of just reigniting that hope inside of these folks. And that's like a real memorable experience for me.
The second thing is he is investing in this land and already has bought and already ready to start this project of a solar field that will be able to power more than 200,000 homes. That solar field is going to be on top of an old uranium mine.
If you look around the fringes around here, you'll find the legacy of where uranium was extracted and enriched and, you know, sent to support the United States nuclear program.
That means that it's radioactive and not able to live on, not able to graze on. It's just useless land. But now, and thankfully, Brett and his company are giving it a chance to be useful land again.
Well, and I feel like it's so easy to take all this for granted. I mean, what is it like to get electricity in your home for the first time?
So we arrived to Eleanor Paddock's Hogan. It's a very traditional type of home. It's kind of a circle home, and you usually have a fire in the middle, and it's definitely off the beaten path.
My homestead.
Homestead. And so this homestead, was it a dream of yours?
Yes.
She's got like this really rocky driveway, but gorgeous vistas, and she can see mountains, you know, right in front of her, this big red rock mountain.
This is where my great-grandparents used to live in the 60s, early 60s, and I grew up on the other side of the hills here.
So I understand so much the connection to the land because her ancestors have lived on that very land.
But this is really home.
Yes, this is really home.
She had kind of gone off and lived off reservation for a while, but she had come back about 10, 11 years ago, I believe. When she came back, she built this home This was after the Bennett freeze lifted. Mm. And she built this home, and then, you know, there were no power lines. When we walked into her place, she had cleared it out for a lot of the solar folks to get in there and do the work. But in the middle of the room was an exposed car battery. That's how she had been powering her phone.
Wow.
Yes.
My cousin recommended that, to use a charging system off the auto battery.
A lot of her food, because she doesn't have a refrigerator, she had a lot of coolers that had been out. She has kind of a barn or an area where she kept things, and a lot of things were just out in there.
All right, this is the moment. Look at that.
Oh, mine.
And I said, what's the first thing or the most excited you are, you know, once these lights turn on and once the electricity starts pumping through these solar panels? And she said,
turn on the refrigerator.
Yeah. Should we move it and get it started up?
Yes.
All right. Can I help? Can we move it over toward where you want it? Okay. I don't hear anything, but I imagine it's...
There it goes. I hear it.
I hear it. A hum.
It's humming.
She's a substitute teacher. And she said, well, as a substitute teacher, I can't wait to just do a lesson plan at home.
And you weren't able to do that before.
No. It was hard for me to do. Technology is going to be here. It's going to bring technology here.
She's a humble and kind of quiet woman, but she was elated, and she really was speechless because it was life-changing. And Brett, he'll tell you through and through, he also is so dedicated to doing this because this is for Navajo people, by Navajo people, and it takes back the sovereignty. Mm. The power of power. This story wrote itself because that word, power, and the power of us has a lot of meaning in this.
It's such great reporting. It's such a great way to kick off this series, The Power of Us. You can actually see some of the images that Ginger's reporting on here tonight on World News Tonight with David Muir. It's a great segment. Ginger, thanks for being with us. Happy Earth Day.
Happy Earth Day.
Okay, one more quick break. When we come back, we are diving into Olympic controversy season head first. One last thing is next.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to libsynads.com now. That's libsynads.com.
And one last thing. With everything happening in the world, there are suddenly concerns about the Olympics. Paris is supposed to have this huge opening ceremony on the River Seine. It's supposed to be the biggest crowd in the history of the Games. But due to security concerns, the number of spectators approved by police keeps shrinking. In fact, recently, France's president said they might have to hold the ceremonies in a stadium like old times for safety's sake. But that is no longer the issue making the biggest splash at these Games. On Saturday, the World Anti-Doping Agency confirmed reports that 23 swimmers from the Chinese Olympic team tested positive for a drug known as TMZ, trimetazidine, not TMZ, the news agency, back in 2021. This was just 7 months before the Games. Information the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency now says was hidden from the public all these years. This report reignited old questions about China's sporting programs. For years, they focused on dominating certain sports with high medal counts, like shooting and diving. It's also spent heavily on sports like women's weightlifting and swimming. They've been racking up medal counts. And at this pre-Olympics warm-up back in 2021, more than half the athletes tested positive. And while Chinese officials have long chalked this up to contamination, suggesting this TMZ might have found its way into a hotel kitchen, this also prompts questions of the people who investigate doping in the first place. Think about it. With results this widespread, this close to the Olympics, you're not going to publicize this? You're just going to let these athletes compete like nothing happened? A senior director for the World Anti-Doping Agency defended their decision not to go public, saying the concentrations of TMZ were small and that this didn't seem to be a pattern of doping by the Chinese. But keep in mind what happened just a year later.
Next here at the Olympics, yet another dramatic turn in the case of Russian skater Kamila Valieva, who was allowed to compete, of course, after testing positive for a banned substance.
In 2022, when news broke that a 15-year-old Russian ice skater was found with this same drug in her system, her and her team's medals were taken away. So why didn't that happen at China? Some have speculated it's because China was about to host games of their own. That's where Valieva got the boot. Some wonder if it's because doping officials are worried that if you lose Russia and China from the games, the Olympics become less meaningful overall. Those within WADA, the anti-doping agency, say they're just not comparable situations in the first place. But keep in mind, several of these Chinese athletes are expected to compete later this summer in Paris. If they appear there on the River Seine in these glorious opening ceremonies, the cleanliness of the water might not be the only question floating around. And if you want more incredible stories this Earth Day, head to abcnews.com, the ABC News app. Nat Geo's also got some incredible stuff today. We will be highlighting some of our favorite stories this week on The Power of Us. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table.
What is happening here?
It's just beautiful chaos.
Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view.
To be honest, I was thinking about asking him for a foot massage, and then I just froze.
This is the best gig on TV.
And you know, anything can happen.
That is what we do here.
I'm not going to lie, the chair's a little small for my behind.
The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.